Good morning. Welcome. We begin our May Day Peace Conference in a chapel. And we do so not simply for the sake of seating capacity, but we gather here to be awakened from the illusion of our separateness. For as we explore what it means to build peace, we begin with the affirmation that such endeavors are informed by our willingness to belong to one another. So today we seek to model what it means to be a peace-building community, to celebrate diversity and embrace our connectedness, and in doing so, explore bold and humble pathways for people of diverse views to accompany one another in the pursuit of peace. Today, as people continue to clash in all corners of the world, and as people of diverse traditions and ideologies encounter one another ever more frequently, in this chapel today, as people of good heart, we're called to transform these encounters from fear and arrogance to respect and appreciation. And so, today, may we explore deep listening and learning as possible keys to the blessed door of reconciliation, transformation, and empowerment. And in doing so, our song of diverse voices joined together may do so in a song of peace. Welcome to Christ Chapel. I invite you to stand as you are able as we sing "When Our Song Says Peace." Please rise.
Holy One, known by many names, we gather this morning in celebration and appreciation, thankful for the days that have been and hopeful for the days that shall be. May we see our lives with a new freshness. May we move beyond what is trivial that we may play our part in the world's renewal. May we say yes again to the visions that honor the movement of peace, that honor human beings and kindness, that unite collaboratively the insights and scholarship of all disciplines, that lift up the wisdom of sages and saints, of prophets and heretics alike. We commit to become ever more impassioned and compassioned people. We commit to friends, family, lovers, children, adversaries, colleagues, neighbors. We honor life and each one present. May we be enriched by this time together. May we become part of a more caring and compassionate world. May we find the courage to make more ethical choices in our relationships. May we foster behavior to preserve and enhance our environments. And as we marvel at life, let us celebrate the times we are co-creators of a better world, and when we leave behind us a trail of encouragement and hope. May this time together be blessed. This is our prayer. Amen. You may be seated. At this time, it is my great honor and privilege to welcome Gustavus Adolphus President Rebecca Bergman to the podium to welcome us with a greeting.
Good morning. It's a great pleasure of mine to welcome you here today. A special welcome to those who have and to those who are serving our nation. It's a great privilege and an honor to have you here today. The May Day Conference is a special day here at Gustavus, a time to focus on peace. The conference was established in 1981, and our conference themes, which you'll see listed in your program, have been of a wide variety. We've focused on land rights, on violence in the community, on hunger, on global water issues, on the banning of landmines, on food security, and on political policies relating to peace and justice. Gustavus is so grateful to the late Raymond, class of 37, and Florence Sponberg of North Mankato, who have been loyal Gustavus alumni and friends, and who are the founders and sustainers of the May Day Conference on Peace. We have family from the Sponbergs attending today, including Michael Sponberg, class of 65, who has served as a member of the May Day Committee. Thank you, Michael. Also, Mim Sponberg Cagle, class of 67, and Elaine Sponberg Larson, class of 72. Thank you for being here with us. We have a wonderful day in store for us, and we will celebrate the May Day legacy with anniversary cake at the end of our day at the closing reception in Alumni Hall at 3:30. And the time in between there, we invite you to think deeply, to think about peace in our world, and to reflect on not only peace in the world, but a chance today to reflect on the peace within each of us, because they are related to each other. And it's the peace within that allows us to strive for and to hope for peace in the world.
Good morning. My name is Dean Curtin. I'm in the philosophy department. And I'm here this morning because I was one of many people on the planning committee for this year's event. I want to begin by seconding the president's appreciation for the Sponberg family. I knew Ray and Florence very well for many years. I'm particularly grateful that Michael has continued to be part of our planning process and that we have Mim and Elaine here this morning. Would you stand up so that we can see you? Those on the faculty who have been here a long time particularly love your mother. She was, among other things, on the Board of Trustees for many years, and we loved her because she spoke truth to power. She reminded many presidents of Gustavus that we have a mission statement, and they ought to keep that constantly in mind. I'd also like to recognize my dear friend and colleague, Professor Richard Leach. Richard is the chair of the May Day Organizing Committee, and I think of Richard among his many skills as being the master cat herder. He's completely collegial and unfailingly happy, and yet somehow we turn out this conference, this splendid conference, year after year. I don't have my glasses on. I don't see Richard. Where are you? I see, oh, of course, he's way in the back. It's my pleasure to introduce the keynote speaker for the 35th Annual May Day Peace Conference, Major Matthew Scherer. When our administration comes to our department and tells us in philosophy that we need to evaluate student learning outcomes, we in the philosophy department tend to roll our eyes and say, well, how do you evaluate a philosophy course 2 days after it's finished? Wisdom takes a long time to mature, right? And we tell Provost Braun that, why don't you get back to us in 20 or 30 years? And we'll see what the effect of our philosophy classes was. Matt Scherer, I'm very proud to say, was my advisee in the philosophy department in the early 1990s. I agree. And I think all my colleagues would be very happy to be evaluated by Matt Scherer and the life he's lived. So, I knew him when he was 18, and I know a lot about him, and I'm not going to mention most of that. Because he's a major now, and he deserves respect. When I first met him, he came to Gustavus on an ROTC scholarship, and he has sustained that commitment to his country, to public service. While he was at Gustavus, he became the classic liberal arts major. He majored in philosophy and geology. And I think to some extent we can understand Matt if we think about those three things, right? Commitment to public service, the kind of empathy, critical intelligence you get from being a philosophy major, combined with the mind of a scientist. Just one small story. I was in India with a group of Gustavus students, and Matt showed up there. He wasn't one of our group. I think the main reason he showed up was one of my students was Anastasia Norton, who became Matt's partner. But I think the other reason is that Matt's just curious. He's curious about the world, the way it works. And I remember one day, students came up and they were concerned that Matt was missing somewhere out there in India. And they were worried about this. I thought, I'm not worried. If anybody can take care of himself, it's Matt. And furthermore, you may think he's lost, but I doubt he thinks he's lost. I think he's just curious. And in fact, he was. I don't think he ever thought that he was in trouble. He showed up, he'd learned a lot, he'd met a lot of people, I remember at one point he was stranded at the intersection of two dusty roads in the middle of nowhere, and he was just fine. Matthew graduated from here in 1993. He accepted a commission in the United States Army, the 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, New York. After his initial service, he and Anastasia volunteered for the Peace Corps, where they served for 2 years in Suriname. And I remember from this period, Matt saying, you know, the thing he valued most was just being a neighbor to these people. He wasn't necessarily the expert, being an American. He didn't necessarily know everything, but he looked for the opportunity to help, whatever that meant, and it meant a lot. He returned to active duty in 2001 and enrolled in the physical therapy program at U.S. Army Baylor University. After completing his master's degree, he was assigned to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. He rose to be the chief of amputee physical therapy at Walter Reed. In 2006, he was deployed to Baghdad, where he was a team leader for amputee rehabilitation and prosthetics. In 2010, he completed his PhD in rehabilitation science from the University of Maryland. And his resume contains a very impressive list, long list of peer review articles. So why invite Matt this year? I confess, I've been looking for an opportunity to invite him back for many years. And when we came up with the topic for this year's conference, I thought, okay, this is Matt's year. Title, The War Within, Can the Soldier Be at Peace? We know that when soldiers come back from war, they always face difficulty. But it's arguable that veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan face particular difficulties. For one, soldiers survive injuries that they wouldn't have survived earlier, and they come back with major hurdles for the rest of their lives. And so the question we're getting at here is, how do these soldiers ever regain a sense of peace in their lives, physically, psychologically, emotionally? And I can think of no one better to address this topic who literally sees every returning veteran who has suffered physical injury. So I genuinely look forward to hearing what Matt has to say. We haven't talked much since 1993. A lot's happened. So please welcome today's keynote speaker, Major Matthew Scherer.
Good morning. President Berglund, Gustavus, faculty, staff, and students, fellow soldiers, fellow Gustavus alumni and visitors, it is an honor and a privilege to stand before you today as a speaker at this 35th annual May Day conference. I'm grateful to this year's May Day committee for providing me with the opportunity to speak on a subject which is very dear to me, and for elevating the topic of service member well-being to this venue and the consciousness of this community. Today, I hope to share with you my perspective as a leader, a soldier, a clinician scientist, and a Gustavus alumnus. While the topic of this year's May Day conference is centered around combat-related stress and its effects on America's service members, I am not a behavioral health provider. Today, I will share my perspective on resilience, recovery, and reintegration through the lens of an Army rehabilitation provider. Here's my disclaimer. I will not suggest in this talk that my experiences, nor those of the men or women I've had the pleasure to serve over the years, necessarily apply to all wounded, ill, and injured veterans. I do hope, however, that our vantage causes each one of you to reevaluate how you frame issues for veterans, identify entitlement and heroism. I look forward to this day of discussion, reflection, and collective enlightenment. I grew up as a physical therapist, or PT, within the halls, wards, and clinics of Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., in the years immediately following 9/11. Upon graduation of my clinical training at the Army Baylor Graduate Program in Physical Therapy in 2003, I was fortunate to be assigned at the Army's flagship medical center for my first duty station as a physical therapist. At that time, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the subsequent pictures of war-related trauma management, for which Walter Reed would become known, had not yet fully occupied the consciousness of the nation. The Department of Defense had not yet elevated troop levels overseas to anywhere near the surge levels that would come in the years ahead. During my first year at Ramsey, however, from 2003 to 2004, troop strength doubled in Iraq to 131,000 sets of boots on the ground. The following year, troop levels in Iraq jumped to 143,000 personnel. The number of service members in Afghanistan at that time was still relatively low by comparison, at about 20,000. Afghanistan's numbers would hit their peak levels in 2008 and 2009, when up to 64,000 personnel would be serving in theater. I cite these figures to provide some perspective on the number of warriors whose worldviews, experiences, and roles within their families and communities would forever change after a single, two, or three or more deployments. It is worth noting that these numbers, though significant, reflect the experience of only a small percentage of our nation's overall population. Per a RAND report published in 2013, the total number of Army personnel who deployed in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, and New Dawn were a mere 1.5 million troop years, relative to the 311 million population of the United States 10 years after the infamous attacks on 9/11 of New York, the Pentagon, and United Airlines Flight 93. While the Department of Defense figures identify only 6,809 killed in war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan, 52,000 people have been physically injured in Iraq and Afghanistan as of March of this year. There are presently over 970,000 claims before the Veterans Administration for wounds, illness, and injury sustained as a result of our conflicts abroad. The effects of blast injuries on our troops have been significant. Public Health Command estimates suggest that as many as 15% of deployed personnel over the last decade sustained some sort of traumatic brain injury. The long-term cost of our wars is also being recognized within the behavioral health arena, where at least 30% of those deployed over the last decade are now suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. 38 per 100,000 in all Iraq and Afghanistan veterans using VA health care have committed suicide, compared with a national average of 11.5 deaths per 100,000 for the general public. Again, it is not my intention to bombard this audience with statistics and figures. In my time as a neuro and musculoskeletal injury rehabilitation provider, I have seen soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines whose injuries would have certainly been fatal in prior conflicts. But by the grace of military operational medicine and the skill of dedicated medics and four deployed surgeons, and they would not have survived. But I can assure you, each of those 970,000 veterans has a story, their partners have stories, their children have stories, and their buddies have stories. Make no mistake, the impact of our nation's decision to wage war over the last decade has significant implications for us all. Today, I would like to share with you an eclectic of experiences, perspectives, images, and opinions that will hopefully encourage reflection and discussion regarding the human cost of our conflicts abroad. Know that in my capacity as a soldier and a leader in the United States Army, I am apolitical. My opinions and assertions are mine alone and should not be construed as official or representative of the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense. Before we get started, I would like to share with you a short clip that all may get a glimpse of into this one service member's experience while deployed.
down the boundaries of your city's light. Stand the heroes waiting for your cries. So many times you did not bring this on yourself. When that moment finally comes, I'll be there to help.
Who are exactly the warriors that fight and win our nation's wars? Let's reflect on the concept of identity for a moment, defined by Miriam as who someone is, the qualities, beliefs that make someone who they are, and how they arrive there. The profession at arms is an institution that dates back to the earliest footholds of Western civilization. In the early 1990s, here at Gustavus, my classmates and I read Homer and Thucydides, poets who characterized the role and importance of the military in ancient civilization. While the means and tactics of waging war have obviously transformed over the centuries, the fundamental principles and cornerstone values of warrior culture have endured over the centuries. Now as then, these values have shaped the identities of our society's combatants. In the Odyssey, Homer praised the hero's courage, military prowess, and guile. In the history of the Peloponnesian War, Thucydides extolled the virtues of service, sacrifice, and duty for the greater good of the city-state through the orations of Pericles. And who among us, warrior or civilian, could not help but be inspired by the absolute measure of duty, loyalty, and personal courage displayed at Thermopylae, as recounted by Herodotus, where 300 Spartans, hopelessly outnumbered, remained unequivocally committed to their mission. Then as now, the profession at arms forges identity among a society's youth, bridging the transition to adulthood. As a profession, the military has grown quite adept at forging swords, from plowshares. We can take a young man or woman and teach him to do the essential business of warfare. It is not glorious, and it can absolutely leave its mark on a warrior. But killing is what a warrior is trained to do. And within the context of war, killing has meaning, and a warrior has a purpose. The sword once forged should expect to be wielded. But a warrior is not a thug or an assassin. The warrior is bound to a code and the laws of war, to fight only armed combatants in a just war, and to live by the values of our profession. As a soldier myself, I see the essential role of these values play in identity formation for our warriors, summed up in the acronym LEADERSHIP, which stands for loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, and personal courage. Internalization of these values in the training environment, in early professional development, and in deployed environments is critical not only for good order and discipline within the ranks, but for the warrior's very survival in combat. These values are nurtured and reinforced, and they allow good and honorable people to do a job that few are cut out to do. According to Aristotle, the virtuous man is he who exemplifies the key values in society and his profession. For the warrior, these values give us a shared sense of purpose, a common moral framework, and establish a code of conduct which help us keep order in the world. These shared values and their impact upon the identity of a young soldier may also play a key role in the resiliency of our wounded warriors when they find themselves struggling from loss, estrangement, or physical and psychological distress. Identity and loss. So who are the men and women whose chosen profession is predicated on fighting and winning the nation's wars? And what exactly have they lost? A significant percentage of our deployed service members over the last decade fell within the range of 18 to 24 years of age during their first deployment. Now I will ask each of you to reflect on where you were and what you were doing between the ages of 18 and 24. What happens during that vital period in a man or woman's life? Well, many of us here in the chapel today, myself included, attended a small liberal arts college during those years. During this time frame, we experienced our first true taste of independence and underwent an often profound identity development. To speak of my own experience in the early 90s, my fellow Gusties and I learned about community. We debated, we dated, we studied philosophy, literature, and the sciences, and we explored new opportunities. For many of us, this four-year period in our lives provided previously unimaginable opportunities for experimentation and growth. Our worldviews were shaped and sharpened by our professors, our classmates, and the formative thinkers of our civilization. The men and women we met here on the Hill became our lifelong friends, our teammates, on campus playing fields, our mentors, professional colleagues, or perhaps even our spouses. I fondly recall leaving Gustavus in the 90s as a liberal artist and a newly minted second lieutenant in the U.S. Army after four concurrent years, which was once called Mankato State University. I was steeped in liberal conventions and off to complete a four-year active duty service obligation with the 10th Mountain Division. My identity was well-defined. Let us contrast what may be a familiar experience of identity formation for many of us with a similar life stage for some of the patients who found themselves in my clinic at Walter Reed Army Medical Center between the years of 2003 and 2007. I think about many of the guys I worked with during those years. Corey, Ed, Butter, Marco, Jimmy, Don, Chris, and so many others. Most were 18 to 22 years old, graduates of high school, infantry basic training, and their advanced individual training. A few of them had graduated from college and the military academy, infantry officer basic, perhaps ranger school, and were perhaps a couple of years older. In basic training and advanced individual training, the first stages of military identity formation are very deliberate. As a young man or woman, you must be trained as a warrior. You learn skills to survive and skills to take the lives of others. You follow an extremely regimented schedule, which is both physically and emotionally challenging. And if the drill instructors have done their job at the end of 10 weeks of basic combat training and 4 to 52 weeks of advanced individual training, you are theoretically prepared to deploy, fight, and win our nation's wars. Weeks or even days before their arrival at Walter Reed, however, how many of them would ever have anticipated that they would be sitting in the amputee clinic or in a hospital ward on 6900 Georgia Avenue? Months before, these young men and women had arrived at their units after preliminary training, as I had 10 years prior, as proud soldiers ready for adventure. They arrived at units such as the 10th Mountain Division, the 82nd Airborne Division, the 101st, or the 1st Cav. Each of these units was steeped in tradition from prior conflicts. They had expectations to live up to. But after 9/11, every one of these units was preparing to deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan to fight the global war on terror. Most of my patients had not had the opportunity to go away to college, live independently after high school, expand their academic or social horizons on safe and secure campuses away from home. Most had enlisted right out of high school. While I, at a similar age, was learning about theories of development, studying Indian economists, and experiencing Zen practice, my younger brothers-in-arms had just returned from an altogether different experience in identity formation, forged on late-night patrols through foreign cities and mountain passes. Their independence and exploration were marked by a different kind of sleep deprivation, punctuated by small arms fire and indirect fire, shouting and screaming while carrying out patrols through hostile neighborhoods or suspicious villages. Many had taken lives and seen considerable civilian suffering. Unlike my own process of identity formation, their first experiences away from home were characterized by hypervigilance and the wild adrenaline of combat. Identity formation for the generation of young warriors, unfortunate enough to be in my amputee clinic, had been nothing short of a crucible. You have heard my words, but today I would also like to share the words of some of the men I happened to meet and work with during my years at Walter Reed, excerpted from a photo documentary entitled Purple Hearts, Back from Iraq, by photojournalist Nina Berman. Every day in Iraq, you think, okay, I made it today. I'm going to make it tomorrow. If it weren't for your buddies lifting up your morale, you would go crazy. You would lose it. There was so much going on. You were never safe. You can't tell who the enemy is. If the bad guys knew that we were only here to help them, if we could show them. But we don't know who the bad guy is. We don't know who to trust. Or another perspective. I really have no idea what my mission was. We were trying to catch the people that were doing stuff, looking for AKs, looking for RPGs, just stuff like that. We found some weapons, but most of the time, we would just go to get people for information. And when we weren't doing that, we were sleeping or eating. We had TVs or PlayStations. I liked it. The excitement, the adrenaline, never knowing what was going to happen. I mean, you could walk into a house and it would blow up. Or you could go in and get fired at. I'm an adrenaline junkie, and I like that. I want to go out there and hump stuff on my back. That's what I was doing. I was doing what I wanted. I did something with my life instead of sitting around and doing nothing. Yeah, the Iraqis were scared. You have like 9 Americans bursting into your house and screaming and pointing weapons. Yeah, they were scared. We would go in when they were sleeping, and we would just bust in and wake them up so they didn't have enough time to get their stuff. I have no political feelings. I'm just a soldier out there. You know, we're trying to help them live like us so that they can be free and not scared to do anything. Trying to set them free. That's how we looked at it. Sometimes we hated being over there because they just didn't respect what we were doing. We were trying to help them and they didn't want us there at all. PFC Randall Clunan. And then each of these individuals had an event that would completely change life as he knew it. A firefight, an MVA, or in many cases, an improvised explosive device. Another perspective. It was a car bomb, a suicide bomber. He just came ripping through the gate and exploded the car himself. I got hit. My nose was sitting over here, like on the left side of my face, and I couldn't breathe, so they had to cut a trachea in. I was bleeding extremely bad. They kept me in a room by myself because I was just, like, really bad looking. I had tubes running through me. For some, the experience of combat was eye to eye with an enemy who was trying to kill him or his buddies. But for many more, the final attack of the war was perpetuated by an enemy using a tripwire or a radio detonated improvised explosive device. They never saw the enemy that took them. They simply suffered the carnage of the attack, and at least for my guys, lived to tell, to dream, and to think about it. Loss. Regardless of how one may personally feel about the decision of a young man or woman to become a warrior, make no mistake, that decision is deliberate. And one day, after enduring hardship, the trials of combat, estrangement from friends and family, and sacrifice for the mission, it happens. One day, despite all the training and the shared experience and the loyalty to one another, each of the individuals I quoted above awoke to find himself in a hospital bed surrounded by others who had recently sustained a traumatic and life-changing event. Each one of them woke one morning to a stark new reality, and the realization was loss. Was their loss physical or sensory motor? Yes and yes. The most obvious evidence of loss came in the form of missing limbs, complex fractures with external fixators holding shattered extremities together like a jigsaw puzzle. However, many lost peripheral nerve function to support volitional muscle movements or experienced impaired sensation. Most lost normal hearing or balance function after blast exposure and traumatic brain injury. Soft tissue injuries, burns, and scars, all were more the rule than the exception. Loss took the form of functional limitations. Injuries limited independence with dressing, walking, toileting, or basic mobility. Those with significant upper extremity involvement lost the ability to use utensils, to cook, or feed themselves in accordance with societal norms and standards. Persons with lower extremity injuries might be challenged in their ability to move from place to place without reliance on others, an assistive device, or a wheelchair. Loss also took the form of limitation of participation in life roles, some temporary, some prolonged. With injuries to the upper extremities, a father might be unable to play catch with his son or confidently hold his newborn daughter, forcing realignment of personal and societal expectations of parenthood. Pain, loss of sensation, or injury to one's reproductive anatomy could limit the ability to interact intimately with one's spouse and fulfill vital life roles as husband, wife, or partner. Inability to perform at one's previous level of physical functioning could restrict livelihood options previously available to a returning veteran. Loss took the form of psychosocial well-being. Phenomena included difficulty sleeping, nightmares, anxiety, hypervigilance, depression, and suicidal ideation. Warriors experienced degraded confidence, decremented self-efficacy, and diminished self-esteem, resulting in a vicious cycle of low societal expectations, soldier underachievement, learned dependence, and a self-fulfilling prophecy of helplessness. Loss in families. The families of our patients experience loss and suffering as well. After months of anxiety, waiting for a periodic email or letter or phone call, mothers, wives, husbands, fathers, significant others, and siblings would receive word that their loved one had sustained an injury of some sort. I saw families cope with extensive orthopedic trauma over the years, but if the warrior was still cognizant and lucid, the reintegration would be a bit easier. Near-death experiences have a way of impressing upon us just how short life can be. Over the years, I watched numerous young spouses accompany their injured warriors to the clinic for rehab. These young families tended to bond with each other, help each other navigate through triumph and trial with perspective. Family members were invited on trips to the White House, athletic events, and the National Capital Region to meet the visiting celebrities and to serve as non-medical attendants at the adaptive athletic trips to the Rockies or elsewhere. On the less glamorous side of things, they had to get used to wound care and grow accustomed to the visible reminders of how closely their partners had come to death. Missing limbs, lines, cords, colostomy bags, or huge external fixators were all constant reminders of just how fragile the human species can be when faced with the steel and fire of modern munitions. Loss of connection with friends and family. We know that having a structured community is essential to processing the horrors of war. The Center of Excellence model that co-located warriors with limb loss provided patients with an instant community of other warriors who got it. Got what, you ask? The intangible of readjusting following deployment. While it was clearly therapeutic to see well-meaning family members and loved ones upon one's return, a civilian family member could never comprehend why the sight of roadside debris along the streets in Washington, D.C. was unnerving when the family took their service member on an outing to Panera Bread in Silver Spring. What a fellow warrior would automatically intuit was that such debris is a telltale sign of a pending IED attack in Iraq. While a spouse might not understand the anxiety associated with a low-riding vehicle that pulls up next to the family rental car at an intersection, the fellow veteran would appreciate the same event as subconscious preparation for a potential vehicle-borne IED attack. While relationships with civilian family members would inevitably reestablish in the weeks and months following the veteran's return home, the pull of the warrior's life was ever present. It may surprise some to hear that despite the safety and the apparent peace offered within the walls of Walter Reed, I can't think of a single warrior that I worked with over the years who wouldn't have given up that tranquility for the opportunity to return back to Iraq or Afghanistan. Loss of context was among the most disorienting, destabilizing, and difficult adjustments for our patients, particularly in the months of their stay, the early months of their stay at Walter Reed. While Walter Reed was certainly a military hospital, it was decidedly not the context in which they found meaning as warriors. Where a soldier may have previously been accustomed to the Spartan trappings of living quarters in a garrison or in a field environment, with the familiar sounds of friends, aircraft, music, or combat in the background, his or her new experience might be the sounds of medical equipment beeping, an overhead page, or the voice of his therapist cueing the next round of exercises. Where one had previously smelled air, smoke, exhaust from the flight line, one's new reality might be better characterized as antiseptic or the unpleasant reminder of a new colostomy bag. Where a typical day had previously been spent cleaning weapons, working out at the gym, blowing off steam with friends, going out on patrols into suspected enemy areas, a day at Walter Reed would more likely be punctuated by visits to PT, OT, prosthetics, the TBI clinic. Where once the next dose of adrenaline was minutes away, the mind-numbing boredom of life as a wounded warrior was almost overwhelming. Unlike the many losses I have described, the juxtaposition of the warrior's context from theater to hospital was less obvious to the outsider. The new environment, while cleaner, safer, quieter, and much closer to family, was decidedly not a place for a warrior. The hospital was away from one's unit, away from one's comrades, and away from the fight that gives meaning to life as a combatant. Loss affects everyone differently, and what was most challenging for one might not have affected another in the least. Within the context of the military treatment facility, however, clinicians, family, visitors from the Warriors unit, and the media all fixated on the loss associated with one's medical condition, never realizing that the most profound blow might be the disruption to the warrior's identity. In another quote from Purple Hearts, Randall C. relates his sense of detachment and disillusionment with life unmoored as a non-combatant, a patient, a survivor. All the excitement that was going on, now, it's nothing. You just watch the news, or you watch war movies on TV, Full Metal Jacket, there's a couple of other ones. I want to find Hamburger Hill. That's a good one about the 101st. My dad, we'd sit there and watch them. A lot of John Wayne movies, too. You know, the cowboys and Indians, and the war movies. Despite what may have seemed a busy schedule of appointments and commitments, one thing a newly arrived patient had at Walter Reed was time. Time to reflect, and reflect they did, spending numerous hours mulling new realities, striving to reconcile how their own sacrifice and those of their comrades may or may not have swayed the tides of world events. Sergeant Josh Olson. We bent over backward for these people, but they ended up screwing us over, stabbing us in the back. A lot of them, I mean, they're going to have us killed. They're not going to go quietly. I know that. You have to take them out and kill them. Loss, body image, and identity. Blast exposure is an indiscriminate force of destruction that takes soft tissue, joints, and often lives without prejudice. Not surprisingly, most of my patients had a number of scars and wounds healing in one phase or another, in addition to the primary injury that brought them to my clinic. Contrary to being self-conscious about such scars, however, in a place like Walter Reed, scars and injuries were commonly borne with reasonable acceptance and often embraced as proof of life and reification of one's warrior identity. When all other missions and other signs of identity had been taken, one's weapon, unit, the mission, even one's relative strength and mobility, scars and wounds remained. The warrior identity was reinforced by scars and evident combat trauma. Even limb loss, once reconciled by the individual, was seen by other patients and civilians at Walter Reed as evidence or proof of service, perhaps even heroism. For some, the loss of a limb made it easier to translate to the identity of a non-combatant. If you had served, been wounded in combat, and were walking about on a sea leg, it would be immediately obvious why you were there and not in the fight. In fact, in the hierarchy of duty-limiting trauma at Walter Reed, limb loss was king. Ironically, there was substantially less stigma associated with one's status as a patient for those with visible injuries. Despite the media's relentless campaign to raise awareness of blast exposure and traumatic brain injury as the signature injury of the War on Terror, the amputees of Walter Reed had achieved a degree of status commensurate with the elite relative to those who were dealing with the so-called invisible wounds, such as TBI or PTSD. Validation of that one was legitimately in need of medical attention and not getting over is a notion that runs deep in military culture, dating back to a soldier's first experience in basic training. At least in the minds of some of our own patients, fellow warriors injured in combat, those at Walter Reed for inpatient psychiatric services had a much more tenuous hold on legitimacy if they still had the capacity to fight. The status of the combat amputee held true outside the protective cocoon of Walter Reed as well. Our patients would discover soon after they achieved the ability to ambulate independently in the community that if you were missing an extremity, in and around the National Capital Region, civilians would assume that you were a warrior and convey upon you the immediate status of hero, with spontaneous effusion, accolades, goodwill, and gratitude. Again, in contradistinction with the isolation of warriors suffering invisible wounds, external validation of sacrifice from anonymous civilian admirers likely had significant impact on the identity of warriors. Whether that impact was for the positive may yet be open to discussion. Far from being self-conscious about the scars or even missing limbs, what was often more concerning to a warrior's self-image were the latent effects of deconditioning in the early weeks and months following their injuries. It was relatively common after prolonged hospital stays, periods of decreased mobility for patients, to experience significant muscle atrophy, weight gain, and dramatic changes in body composition. These physical changes were a significant blow to one's self-image as a warrior, an athlete, a man, or a woman, respectively, attacking the psyche on multiple planes at once. Imagine the shock factor. At one moment, you are running through the streets of Iraq or Afghanistan with 100 pounds on your back, with all the strength and confidence of your youth. You're strong as hell, tough as nails, grounded in the present reality of war, and your identity as a soldier. And then, in the next minute, white, searing pain and your invincibility is stripped away. You wake up and discover that your lean muscle mass, forged by years of sweat, discipline, and training, has given way to atrophy and adipose tissue, with pain and comorbid issues you'd never imagined possible. If you found yourself in a wheelchair, you now spent much of your day looking up at people as they came to visit you. To be clear, the view from 4 feet in a wheelchair is not simply 2 feet different from the perspective of a 6-foot warrior. Looking up at the world from a hospital bed might reinforce a subconscious sense of dependence not experienced since childhood. So far, I've talked a lot about identity, loss, and a great many challenges faced and surmounted by returning warriors. The question of the day, of course, is, can the soldier be at peace? My resounding answer to that question is yes. Even in the presence of significant physical trauma, my colleagues and I watched many come to us, literally snatched from the jaws of death, and leave however many months later, walking, or perhaps even running, on a prosthetic limb or limbs. Reflecting on my experiences over the years, it seems that the path back to physical and psychosocial well-being began with the deliberate process of enhancing capabilities to function. Interestingly, this is a model that I was exposed to in my time here at Gustavus over 2 decades ago. It struck me as an innovative approach to development economics then, and it has informed my thinking on return-to-duty decision-making for concussed service members in my work over the last few years. To apply Dr. Amartya Sen's model briefly, we can describe the well-being, performance, and potential of a warrior in terms of a common mathematical construct, a vector. Using this model, an individual's capabilities can be understood and quantified by the overall magnitude of the vector, determined in part by premorbid education, socioeconomic status, physical well-being or lack thereof, and social connections. Other factors that might increase the magnitude of the well-being vector might be a warrior's family support, marital status, military background, sense of self-efficacy, or any number of other variables. Though admittedly abstract, the ability to normalize disparate domains of functioning in a meaningful way may be necessary if we as a community are to truly quantify and compare the differences between the functional and the dysfunctional. Without a means to measure our desired end state, how can we hope to effectively address the problem? Rehabilitation and reintegration. A blast which is powerful enough to take a limb is sufficiently dangerous to disrupt multiple body systems and leave the survivor with concussion, soft tissue injuries, and often post-traumatic stress related to the event. Given the potential for polytrauma, it was not unusual for our patients at Walter Reed to stay a year or two as they underwent multiple washouts of their residual limbs, reconstructive surgeries for comorbid conditions, or revisions of their amputations. On the administrative side, most also spent months seemingly in limbo, navigating medical evaluation boards and determining their fitness for duty, which would drive future compensation and next steps in their journey. Following their initial weeks in the ICU, function typically returned steadily as we transitioned them into rehab. In the physical therapy clinic, we would address a wide variety of impairments, overcoming pain, improving range of motion in contracted limbs, or managing post-concussive deficits like dizziness or vertigo. In the military advanced training clinic, our amputees would undergo frequent refitting and training on lower or upper extremity prosthetic devices as their residual limbs approached a stable volume. The road back to normalcy for our men and women, both physically and psychosocially, began in the clinic with hard work, direction, and goal setting. Patients received constant encouragement from a community of fellow warriors in transition, family members, providers, and numerous other supporters. Our PT clinic was always a lively place. At any given time, one might see a couple of dozen patients working with their therapist or prosthetist, conferring with their surgeon or their physiatrist, or launching sorties of sarcastic jibes, or occasionally genuine encouragement to their brothers and sisters in arms. On any given day, a therapist might be working with 10 to 20 patients at various stages of recovery. Peer mentorship and counseling were deliberately orchestrated by our team, with newly arrived patients assigned mats next to those who had been there for a few months ahead of them, with a very similar perspective on different types of injuries, and demonstrated some expectations for their own physical recovery. Therapists spent countless hours over the next few weeks helping their patients rebuild core and hip strength, challenging them with upper and lower extremity resistance training, and reconditioning the cardiovascular systems in anticipation of the enhanced metabolic demands of walking with prosthetic limbs. A multiple hour per day rehabilitation regimen was a practice already familiar to our warriors. Clinic time was structured, challenging, and goal-oriented. After losing limbs, functional mobility, and their status as armed combatants, the practice of daily exercise was actually one of the few warrior rituals which had not been stripped from them as they entered the walls of Walter Reed. For many, conditioning became religion early on in their stay as they spent hours in the clinic to clear their heads, wear themselves out, fight off boredom, or simply to find meaning in hard work. As the weeks progressed, my team of dedicated amputee PTs would run their patients through daily gait retraining and complex balance and dynamic stability drills. For those with the determination and discipline, not even running was impossible. Many of our patients learned to run on a C-shaped cheetah leg within the first 12 to 18 months of their stay. Those who wished to remain on active duty would train on various soldier-specific drills, like individual movement techniques to evade enemy fire, clearing rooms with simulated weapons, or even facing virtual opponents in a multi-million dollar virtual reality simulator. Therapists exposed patients to new sports-specific activities to boost their self-confidence and challenge all their misconceptions about themselves, with rock climbing, amputee golf, and water sports. As rehab providers, we deliberately progressed our patients through a series of medical and rehabilitation milestones, addressing their musculoskeletal impairments and functional limitations. But in many ways, all of this work was simply setting the stage for something bigger. While exertion and commitment were our tools, self-efficacy and the ability to transcend the confines of focused medical treatment and the rehab model was our goal. From a conventional civilian rehabilitation perspective, at 18 months post-injury, many of our wounded warriors could have been discharged as independent were they at a comparable civilian polytrauma center with all rehab goals met and with full expectation that they would return to their prior life roles. But our men and women weren't just injured athletes or survivors of a serious MVA, these men and women had been to war, watched their buddies die, and had themselves killed for God and country, shouldering the awesome burden of taking enemy lives in accordance with national security objectives approved at the highest levels of our democracy. And so, despite all the medical care they had received from physicians, therapists, psychologists, or other members of the multidisciplinary teams during the course of their stay, many experienced a sort of existential angst given uncertain futures, challenges to identity, and the shock of a sudden transition from one world to another. I do not intend to conflate or oversimplify the multitude of stressors that our wounded warriors were managing. However, I believe their crisis was at least in part rooted in issues that modern medicine and clinical rehabilitation were not poised to address. As PTs, my colleagues and I became more than just providers to these men and women. After hours together, day after day, for months on end, we came to know more about our patients, their trials, and triumphs than almost anyone else in our life. We shared significant milestones of loss and recovery, ranging from clinical issues or medical boards to our day-to-day lives outside the clinic. We became privileged confidants, and they became extended members of our family. It occurred to me in those years that despite occasional criticism in the media about how veterans were being managed through the VA or the DoD systems, after a few months at Walter Reed, most of my patients seemed to have a pretty healthy perspective on the challenges and barriers to reintegration. Walter Reed and its sister facilities in San Antonio and San Diego were different from other environments of care, given unlimited available resources, staff-to-patient ratios, and the ability to manage cohorts of like-injured wounded warriors. Families were billeted in nearby Fisher houses to support their loved ones. Warriors in transition, as they would come to be known later in the decade, were managed with a multidisciplinary focus that addressed their individual constellations of rehab needs, pain management, orthopedic and behavioral health needs. Suffice it to say that these men and women had the best medical team assembled that the Department of Defense could assemble. But was that sufficient? If one were to ask our patients during those years whether the formidable behavioral health resources marshaled on their behalf were useful to them during their post-injury transitions, I believe that many of them would resent the implication that their responses to tragedy were in any way pathological. Many were frustrated by the stigma in the media that all vets had PTSD and were having trouble coping. Nonetheless, many of the veterans who returned from conflicts in Iraq have been treated for depression or anxiety with medication and counseling. Is this an appropriate treatment strategy from a medical management perspective? Absolutely. Certainly, however, for a medical model to make sense, there must, by definition, be pathology. And this can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Perhaps this line of questioning begs the question, have we as a society over-pathologized the readjustment and reintegration process? For many veterans, no amount of medical management could replace the mission, commitment to team, connection to comrades, or the adrenaline of combat, which had so recently given them purpose. Grounded and a raid d'etat in the weeks and months before their injuries. This sense of purpose was born in experiential practice. Others had shed their warrior identities, but failed to supplant them within the context, with a new context to give them meaning. Despite newly formed connections with peers in the clinic, an exceedingly positive community of peer visitors and clinicians and therapy dogs, and a seemingly endless rotation of celebrities rotating through the clinic through a proverbial rotating door, many still felt unmoored and without purpose. Patients experienced in lingering restlessness and anxiety that for all outward appearances could look like post-traumatic stress disorder or adjustment disorders. They experienced very real anxiety about what life had in store for them after they departed Walter Reed. The clinical counseling could not prepare them for. Soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines assigned to the warrior the Wounded Warrior Battalion were still living in a protected cocoon with minimal contact with the outside world. To help bridge this gap, we found that there was no greater therapy than adaptive athletics. In the early years after the war, from 2003 to 2007, the proponents of adaptive athletics were DC volunteer groups like Achilles Road and Track Club, who introduced wounded warriors to specialized hand crank cycles custom fit to the specific needs of athletes with upper and lower extremity limb loss. Cycling provided an additional means of conditioning, an opportunity for camaraderie outside the clinic, as well as opportunities to compete in local races and extended rides on both national and international circuits. Soldiers entered races in newly created hand crank cycling divisions, traveling up and down the East Coast to participate in the Boston Marathon, the New York Marathon, and the Army 10-miler. At a very basic level, the ability to move under one's own power with skill, speed, and independence was hugely therapeutic. Local groups like Achilles and later the Ride to Recovery were a natural extension of our work in the clinic, using exercise and teamwork to build community, rebuild the athlete identity, and to provide a structured opportunity for warriors to spend time on the road, on the trails, and outside the walls of Walter Reed. Groups like Ride to Recovery also took very deliberate steps to appoint staff members like a former chief of mine, Colonel retired Barb Springer, to direct programming, ensuring that buddy riders were trained to counsel, support, and advise warriors in transition as they navigated life issues during countless hours on the road. Organizations like Disabled Sports USA and the Disabled American Veterans hosted annual trips to places like Breckenridge, Beaver Creek, and Vail, Colorado, to teach adaptive skiing and snowboarding as a new vehicle to experience mobility, adrenaline, and athleticism. These programs were extremely powerful because they emphasized capability enhancement, first teaching warriors how to ski or snowboard, and then empowering them to develop the self-confidence and have self-efficacy that comes with practice of an activity. Having the opportunity to attend the Hartford Ski Spectacular as a clinician in 2005, I watched firsthand as many of my patients overcame a fear of falling, speed, and the unknown. From a reintegration perspective, adaptive winter sports were a phenomenal vehicle for veterans to share new experiences.